Hey everybody, welcome to another Bald Move Prestige Movie Edition. Today we're going to be talking about a great film, 1961's The Hustler. It was directed by Robert Rosen, written by Sidney Carroll and Robert Rosen. Oh, yeah, Robert Rosen, who's a writer, director in this one. Mm-hmm. Starring the late, great Paul Newman, Jackie Gleason, Piper Laurie, and not quite introducing, but I think this is only his third film role, George C. Scott.
Yeah, you might know him from such things as Dr. Strangelove.
Yep.
And Patton. Dr. Strangelove. Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Jackie Gleason, of course, you know, I don't think Paul Newman needs any introduction, yeah. But Jackie Gleason, of course, famous for The Honeymooners, classic 1950s sitcom. And Piper Laurie, I didn't look up her roles. I should have, because these are the times where people need it. You know, no one needs to know what films Ewan McGregor has been in, but like Piper Laurie, I did you dirty. I'm so sorry. Mm. So I had never seen this film before. It's a black and white, but it's probably stylistic reasons. I mean, obviously you could film in Technicolor back then, but it's a black and white film. It's about a pool shark that goes around and plays pool for money. And when he's not doing that, he's hustling marks out of their hard-won pool dollars.
Yeah, pool bucks.
It's funny because like when you said that you liked this film, because I've known you for a long time, and I know you're pretty resistant to like watching quote-unquote old films. And I see this, and it's like, you know, the opening scenes are like, and I remember watching the first 5 or 10 minutes, and I'm like, this is a black and white film. It's kind of like right there at the ragged edge before like method acting really took over Hollywood. So there's a lot of like very stagey performances and like, but the cinematography is pretty inventive, mm-hmm. and the shots are pretty creative, but. I could definitely see the dialogue, but I'm like, is it the pool? Because I know that you like to play pool. What is it about this film that Jim likes? But then like 15, 20 minutes, I was just completely engrossed.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like minor league obsessed with this film. I want to watch it again. I want to get the Criterion edition. I want to listen to a bunch of commentaries. I want to read a bunch of more reviews. Tell me about what. How did you come to watch this fucking film, and what sucked you in about it?
So my brother recommended this to me, and I don't know how he came to be such a big fan of Paul Newman specifically. But at one point he had seen like basically every movie that Paul Newman had been in. And I had seen The Sting, with, you know, Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And that's just fantastic. That movie is so good. And so when he recommended this to me and said, hey, Paul Newman's in this and it's about pool, I was like, okay, awesome. I actually grew up around a lot of people who played pool. We had a pool table mm-hmm. in one of our houses where we lived for years in the basement, and I got pretty good at pool.
The first time I met you, when your dad invited me to his house, you were in the basement with your brother wearing roller skates, going around the pool table, sinking crazy shots as like what? As like a 10, 11-year-old?
Yeah, for sure.
12-year-old? Yeah. It was tracks now that I think about it.
We used to play a game where we would skip roller skate because the whole floor was tile down there. And so actually it was linoleum. We'd roller skate around the pool table, and the rule was you had to take the shot before the cue ball stopped moving. And you're on roller skates, so like we're, you know, level of difficulty
mobile Gundam speed pool is what you're playing down there.
Right, so I was a big fan of pool. My uncle, in fact, was actually very good at pool. He lived a bizarre life, but at one point in his family home with his wife and two children had a pool table in his living room, just taking up the whole damn thing. And they tolerated it. And he was really good, like tournament level kind of pool player. Not, you know, he was no Willie Moscone, but he was quite good.
No Minnesota Fats.
No Minnesota Fats, no Fast Eddie, but still very good. And so, you know, when Paul Newman and pool collide, that's kind of like a pretty good intersection for me. And so I watched it and I just kind of fell in love with the world they created. And I don't know how like accurate the depiction of a pool player's life.
Sure.
Although the basic concept, the hustling aspect of a pool player,
Right.
I think is the thing that gives it more of a seedy sort of, you know, forbidden tone to the whole thing. Whereas if it was just a tournament pool player who was kind of straight up pool player, it wouldn't have nearly the same sort of draw for me. I like the dirty sort of underhanded corrupt world that they're playing in.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think this movie was kind of a defining movie for the pool scene of that entire generation, and kind of,
oh, I can imagine,
lingers to this day. I will say, I, you know, it's the title of the stream that we're doing, but it's probably the greatest pool movie ever made. And that's part of what drew me to it, because there weren't a lot of pool movies that I could even think of. Like, I'm struggling to think of one other than The Color of Money, which is just the sequel to The Hustler.
Didn't Vince Vaughn make a movie that was kind of about playing pool? Like, I feel like...
That sounds right.
Yeah. So there's... Because I have seen another pool movie besides this one. But I had no idea that the Hustler and Color of Money were like sequels either. Now I really want to see The Color of Money.
So The Color of Money, Paul Newman's in that as like Tom Cruise's manager, trainer, whatever, you know, George C. Scott kind of is in this, but he's the same character, Fast Eddie Felsen.
Huh. That's cool. Yeah, I had a, like, when in my like teenage years, kind of like developed a love of pool because one of the local elders, you know, the witnesses typically attend three Bible meetings, you know, Christian meetings a week. And one of them would happen in people's homes. It's called the Bible study.
Yeah.
And the person was hosting in my neighborhood was this elder who had a pretty nice house, and he had a big pool table in his basement.
Can we call him the horse? Because I feel like every good pool player needs a good nickname, like Fats or
the horse.
Fast Eddie.
Yeah, Fast Larry the Horse. And he intimated that he was a bit of a hustler, because he's a bit of a ne'er-do-well in his youth. He converted late in life to the witness, and he had a lot of pictures of him, like, you know, skin-tight t-shirt, cigarette rolled up into his sleeve with a pool stick in his hand. And he could shoot straight pool, baby. And he taught me the basics of the game, because, like, you know, anybody want to stay afterwards for an hour or two and kind of hang out, that's where I learned my love of country music. Learned the shoot pool at a not very proficient, but, you know, I don't embarrass myself level. So I have a lot of fond memories of spending a lot of time around a pool table myself. And the pool in this movie is actually really excellent.
Yeah.
I was shocked at how, in my research, my first question is, like, Paul Newman can really, you know, shoot pool. And he's got some, like, I think above average shots that he sinks. Of course, you can do take after take, but I guess Jackie Gleason was actually kind of a pro level player himself.
Yeah.
And then they had, as a technical consultant and for insert shots, a legit pool pro. The do, like, because there's some just ridiculous shit, like the things where a ball jumps over another ball and then spins backwards to come and knock something in the corner pocket. And I don't think either one of that was handled by the pool professional. But there's a lot of wide shots of Gleason and Newman just sinking pretty tough shots.
Yeah, I think that
in
was
sequence too.
That was one of the things that the director, you know, kind of leaned on is Jackie Gleason's ability at pool. He gave him a lot of wide shots where you'd see the table and him and shooting that. The dirty secret about pool is that it's all angles. And if you can hit a ball straight and you can hit a point on a rail that, like, the pool pro tells you to hit, your trick shot will work, you know? So I feel like Paul Newman in a lot of those shots, because he actually hits a really excellent shot where he calls a one ball in a corner pocket and he just nails it. And it's in this group of this cluster of other balls. And it's a really, really hard shot. But I'm sure the pool pro was just like, looks at it, says, hit this spot right here. And Paul Newman, you know, having trained to hit the ball straight, is able to hit that shot.
Uh-huh. And if you can, if it takes you 10 shots to do it, it's like, not like they're, you know, there's actually a lot of pool in this, but not enough to where, you know, if it took someone 20 shots to make it, then you got probably the time and the schedule to do it. But I think that helps a lot, because the other thing is, I don't think because I also, there's very many different ways to play pool. You know, they're playing like straight pool, nine ball, billiards. I don't know the intricacies of any of those games. I usually played eight ball when I was playing, which is kind of like the beginner ball. But you don't really need to. You don't really need to understand how the fuck to play pool to understand this movie, because in much the same way that like Searching for Bobby Fischer does not require you to understand how to play chess.
Yeah.
It's just the backdrop to tell this morality play of a man that is obsessed with being a winner to the extent that it makes him a loser. And I was always, you know, speaking about all about the angles, like the first 20 minutes of this movie was me trying to figure out the film's angle, because it starts with like a small time hustle with Paul Newman's character and his like mentor, his manager, his straight man that enables him to do some of these confidence, because a lot of this, the hustling part of it is just confidence, you know, scams like, oh, yeah, we're just in town for an insurance salesman convention. And my buddy here's got the salesman of the year, and he's going to get a big commission check. And oh, he's been drinking a lot. And oh, you just spent your last 4 months of commissions, Eddie, you're in trouble. I can't watch this. We got to get out of here. And then the local pool sharks like starts smelling blood in the water, and you take him for some money and you run. And they make it a point of like, you know, Paul Newman, so good looking, so charismatic, so good at that aspect of it that he gets himself into trouble. So then in the second, when we first meet Minnesota Fats and he's wanting to win 10 grand off of him, and then he loses, end up losing 18. I'm like, is this like going to be like some multi-stage hustle though? He's like doing this act to take him for $100,000 or something. But no, that's not what it is. It's like he has this fatal flaw. He's got no character. He's a loser. It's something missing inside him. It's a lot like watching an addict, honestly.
I think some of the best movies are movies that say something about the human experience. And this movie very much is a question of what are you going to do with your life? You know, what is it that makes somebody a winner versus a loser? Because there are a lot of characters in here who look like winners, who by the end of the film come out looking like losers. George C. Scott's character, Burt Gordon, is probably the prime example. You think he's a winner because he's very wealthy. He has, you know, a keen understanding of humans and how to control and manipulate them. But by the end of the movie, you see that that is so incredibly hollow when it comes to the lessons that, you know, Paul Newman's character, Fast Eddie, learns over the course of the film.
Yeah, and he blames it all on, you know, character. Like, that's what makes a winner or loser. But then you find out that he has, you know, where it counts, zero character. He's completely amoral. And what kind of life does that lead him? Yeah, that's, boy, I tell you, I don't want to spoil the film too much, because I imagine there's a lot of people out here that have not seen it. And again, like, if you're the type of person that hates like old timey movies that are slow paced, etc., fully know that this is coming from, as recommended from, a man who typically feels that same way.
I feel you.
And it just really works. And the core performances are, like, I think George C. Scott is amazing. Incredible. I think Paul Newman is, again, there's a couple things that very much feel stagey, like the previous era of Hollywood. There's still some you can, and but I think that transition is kind of fascinating. Yeah. And some things he does where he's just like hanging out with Sarah, the Piper Laurie character, where he's just effortlessly embodying this character, and he's just so cool and so good. It's a lot of fun to watch.
And that performance from Jackie Gleason is understated. Like, he doesn't have a huge role in this, despite being, you know, one of four characters in the entire movie who is actually a character.
Has a speaking role. Yeah,
he has a lot of screen time, but he doesn't do much speaking. He's much more like this calm, cool, collected presence through the film. But you feel like there's a sadness in there. There's a very serious and intimidating presence from him at times. And it's all conveyed via looks and movement, and there's not much in the body way of language, dialogue.
Yeah. There's an early scene where, you know, Paul Newman meets Minnesota Fats for the first time, and you're watching Jackie Gleason play, and he's kind of narrating, like, look at this fat man. Yeah. He moves like a ballerina, and he's like at this fluid grace, not a way. And you can see it in his performance. Like, you know, it doesn't help or doesn't hurt that Jackie Gleason's very talented at pool, but just the way he's working around his table methodically, sinking shot. And that's, I think, one of the, you know, that's the psychology of pool that I think is interesting. The fact that, like, when you're running a table and the other guy can do nothing, literally, like, as long as if you don't miss your shot, the other guy doesn't get to play at all.
Yeah. I mean, you could win, like, $18,000 off them having never given them a shot, like the way that straight pool works.
Yeah. And it's like fundamentally unfair. It's like, imagine a basketball game where you hit your first shot and you just keep, as long as you can keep making them, the other person just has to sit and hope for you to fuck up a shot. And the psychology into, like, the kind of shit talking that they do, and like it's like watching it's got all the excitement of like high stakes poker, except for the game is infinitely more interesting, I think.
Yeah. And there's also like you know, it's partially down to this movie and the hustler life, but like there's this dirty aspect to it, but there's also this very respectful attitude that all the pool players have too, which is strange. It's a weird blend. If there were something dirty about like tennis, right, where everybody's just
right,
or golf, it's a weird life, a weird thing, a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking.
Well, it's like when he walks into Ames Pool Hall, which I understand is like an actual real life kind of like, or back in the day Mecca, and he walks in and is like, this is like church. It is something kind of holy and sacred, and all the players, even though they're all trying to scam each other, there is something about the purity and the sanctity of the competition that they do respect.
Yeah, but I feel like it's like church in the same way that, like, yeah, God's there, but also there are the horny teenage girls who are there. It's like this blend of sacred and really just raunchy. Yeah.
And it's embodied, like, when he goes into, he's like, so this is just a pool hall, and the guy at the cashier table that's all fenced in, there's a giant sign that says no gambling too.
Yeah.
Even though that's the only thing that happens here. And he's like, there's no bar, no pinball, no bowling. It's just pool. This is Ames, mister. Like, there's, that's the other thing. Like, the primary reason I love these older films is when you get to see that, like, that dialogue that crackles, you know? And there's a lot of that stuff. Like, Minnesota Fats is kind of like prospect hunter. Maybe he's his manager or bankroller, like is sizing up Paul Newman's Fast Eddie. And he's like, you want some free advice? And Paul Newman's manager comes back, oh, how much will it cost us? Yeah. Like, that's just a really, there's so many shots like that, like, lines like Piper Laurie's character, Sarah, is this crazy emancipated woman for the day. And she's got so many great lines, like, you know, it's like, I'm a college girl. I go to college on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Paul Newman's like, what do you do the other days? I drink.
No, their whole courting scenes are really just crisp, real crisp.
Yes. Yes. But there's also, like, this is a human tragedy, because, like, the whole time, and that's the other thing. It's like, I kept on trying to figure this film out, and at the halfway point, I kind of gave up. But like, it's like, oh, she's the hustler. She's emotionally hustling him. That's not true. But there's like everyone in this. What you understand is everyone in this film is a hustler of some sort, and someone's being hustled or is hustling someone else. But it's a tragedy because, you know, when she begins a love affair with him, and he's like very strong, and she pushes him away, he's like, no, you're too hungry. Mm-hmm. And then something like, you know, Eddie, I forget exactly what she says. Oh, you know, I got troubles, and I can tell you got troubles. We should really just kind of leave each other alone. Kind of like, I like you too much to involve you in my hustling. Mm-hmm. But then they can't resist each other because they're also kind of weirdly perfect for each other. They perfectly understand.
Yeah.
Like, they're both living outside the margins of what society deems acceptable for them to be doing.
If only they could play it straight long enough to understand that about each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of I remember spoilers here. We're gonna start spoiling the shit out of it. But there's this the point where the movie really made me like at one point Paul Newman slaps her,
Yeah.
which was like a fucking moment. And then when George C. Scott kind of worms his way into Paul Newman's character's life and just starts eating it from the inside out like a vial, like he drank a vial of acid, turning him against Sarah. Then Sarah, like I, it's and the movie kept going like even darker from where I was expecting it to go. It's very tasteful for like Hollywood standards. Like her the eventual suicide is shot in a way that like you have to, it's like a child wouldn't understand why Paul Newman is so upset with what he's seeing in there because there's like just a spot of blood on the sink
Right.
and that's it.
And it's all in
There's
black and
not a,
white, so there's no real
yeah.
blood.
In 2020, the whole fucking bathroom floor would be red and it would be in vivid Technicolor and you'd have the full horror of it. But,
No, I love the way that scene is shot. I think it puts
it's really
you
good.
in the moment with Paul Newman because you're not sure what happened there until you see the aftermath.
But the film, like, it's like the whole first act is just this breathless thing where it's like, I thought like when he sits down with Minnesota Fats and he's starting to shoot this game of pool, I'm like, well, this is going to be, he's going to get his ass whipped and then he's going to level up through the whole film with and then he's going to come back and win for good. But like that first match, it's weird. It's almost like if you were watching Rocky and the final fight happens in the first act. And then the climactic fight is just like a minor rehash of that first amazing fight.
Yeah.
Because this pool game, they start playing pool at 8 p.m. and they don't stop playing until 4 o'clock in the net. I think 4 o'clock the next afternoon.
Yeah.
It's this weird Lamaze kind of endurance pool.
Yeah,
And
that's it's I don't know if that's a normal thing. I feel like it's not. You as a hustler, you're probably in and out pretty quick in these places so as not to get found out. But yeah, I mean, everybody knows what the score is here, right? That
right, because this is the level
nobody's
where
hustling.
nobody's being hustled. This
Yeah.
is just two professionals going at it for money. It's a prize fight,
But they
and
try. It's hilarious because Newman comes in there like, "Oh, who's that fast Eddie Felsen guy? Who's he? Never heard of him."
right, yeah, he,
Like he's gonna try and hustle these guys, but then it becomes clear, they're just playing at some point.
And there is, and that's the thing. It's like it's never not a hustle because like
Yeah.
Fats agrees to play for $100 a game, which is a princely sum back in the day. But the next time he comes in, he wants $1,000 a game because he's like, I know you're dangerous now because you almost
Yeah.
beat me. In fact, the only reason you didn't beat me is because you're a loser.
That's the thing. I.
So why did Paul Newman comes up with that. He rolls up into Ames. He tells his manager, I'm gonna win $10,000 tonight. Hot damn! Can you imagine rolling out here at $10,000? Like that's his dream scenario, and he gets it in like the wee hours of the morning. But the Minnesota Fats won't concede the victory. So it's
Yeah, it's more about
like,
like ego and pride and domination of Fats than it is really about the
yeah.
money.
I wonder if Fats knew that. Maybe Fats is just better at drinking and staying up late. And he's
Yeah.
like, this is a rope-a-dope like strategy that if I just keep this guy on his feet long enough, he's going to tire before I do. And then I'll be able to win my money back.
And it works out, yeah.
But it's like, that's the whole deal. And there's a really heartbreaking scene where he has with Piper Laurie where he's talking about, like, I just want all my life, I felt like a loser and I want to be a winner. There's like I don't know, it's quintessentially the thing that I think most people can identify, the idea of when you're in the zone and like you feel like you can't miss and like that's a high, like did you get a mastery of something, or you're at a level where it's like just everything feels like suddenly easy and you just want to chase that high. But like her saying that like you are, like Eddie, you are a winner. And you're winning in a way that like most men can't even conceive of, but it wasn't enough. Like he rolls into Ames with a fantasy amount that he's going to win from this guy, gets it, and he loses it because somewhere during the night, winning that money wasn't the important thing. It's getting Fats to like roll over and say, you're the best.
Yeah, it's chasing. It's the same thing that Bert is looking for, right? In that moment, he's as bad as Bert. Bert's looking to simply. You can see over the course of the movie that once he gets Fast Eddie under his thumb, he wants to break him, and he essentially wants to subjugate him and be superior. He gets off on the superiority of it, of the domination aspect. And that's kind of where Eddie was at the beginning of this movie. And by the end, he's you know, come around and become a real winner by saying, I don't need that anymore. That's not what defines me.
So this is first game at 4 o'clock in the morning. They decide to up the ante to $1,000 a game. And they go out and they send out for drinks because there's no bar here. So they send Preacher out and he goes to a 4 o'clock in the morning gambling marathon, poker marathon, and gets George C. Scott. What is George? I know what he becomes later. He becomes the dark shadow of Eddie's first mentor manager, who actually was a father figure to him. Mm-hmm. And he should have stuck with him throughout the movie. You know, someone that genuinely cared for him. But what is George C. Scott in this film? Like, why did Preacher go get him? He's not Fats's money man. What is he?
I had that same question. What is the relationship? And I gather that he is just a gambler. And he has
like we got fresh blood in town.
Yeah, like he's got this relationship with Fats because Fats is the best, and he knows he can reliably bet on Fats because he's got character. But beyond that, I don't know. I'm not sure why they go get him in this moment.
There's a couple questions I had like that, because I think this film is, you know, telling a story like it's possible to watch Breakfast at Tiffany's and not realize that. Who's the star of that? Aubrey Hepburn? No, not. Is it Aubrey Hepburn?
I've never seen it. I don't know.
It's the female protagonist is a prostitute. And it's entirely possible to watch that film and not realize it. Think maybe she thinks she's a wealthy socialite or whatever, because the film is couched in, like, if you're watching it in contemporaneously, you know exactly what they're going for.
Yeah.
But me, as a guy who's, you know, watched movies gritty where, like, you know, being a prostitute's not that big a deal, and it's the thing. Like, you know, like even Pretty Woman doesn't, like, that's probably the most tasteful I can think of in my generation. And it's still pretty clear that she's a working girl. Yeah.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
and get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
What is Sarah doing on Tuesdays and Thursdays? Because she's not going to college, I don't think. Does she have another man who's that she's like, you know, spends those days with? Or like, I know something that you're supposed to understand that why that she's got some other whole side hustle going on. That's something along those lines. But I couldn't quite put my finger on what exactly the nature of it is, because I don't have the 1960s bullshit translator.
Yeah, maybe that's it. The movie, I think, is intentionally vague. She never, you know, she makes up stories about a lot of things. And I'm not sure I can separate the fact from the fiction. At some point she says, look, it's my dad who sends me all this money. And he does it basically to just keep me out of his life because he never liked me.
But she's in that story where she's coming clean. She also mentions that she's not really like that. This is every time another man leaves her. Or she outgrows it, she essentially comes up with another fiction to tell the net. So it's right. Like, is she now like spinning the origin story of the new version of her persona? And it's, I've only seen the movie once. Like, I was left with a lot of questions like that. Like, you know, it's almost like if you'd seen a movie called The Hustler that was based on Sarah, and Paul Newman is just like, where you go make your money, Eddie? You know, I go shoot some pool. Like, yeah, that's kind of true. But like, what? Uh-huh. It doesn't tell the whole story of what their deal is.
I think that's definitely intentional. It's supposed to be muddy. It's supposed to be like she is maybe up to some game. She's maybe not. You don't really know as an audience. At least, you know, I don't know as an audience. Maybe in 61, everybody knew. It was just unspoken. But yeah, I think like they're both hustling and they're just trying to show the parallels there.
There's a couple of things I also liked. Like, there's a scene of him where he, like, is pissed off. Well, he hasn't pissed off. He just walked out on his old manager, and he's trying to come up with another bankroll to get, you know, Minnesota Fats back on the line. And he plays at this just, like, you can tell this neighborhood bar is, like, just the worst kind of, like, smoky-filled, shithole, pool, junky place. Mm-hmm. And I have a bar in my neighborhood called The Arena that's exactly like this. Like, no vertical surfaces made out of the same constructed material. Like, nice. The floors and the ceilings don't meet at the same angles. There's a whole bunch of bizarre altitude changes the floor plan makes, so who the hell knows? There's another thing. And here's where, like, old Hollywood, the scene of them breaking his thumbs was so wildly done that I'm like, did they rape him with a pool stick? Like, what the hell happened? This is such a bizarre. So, like, until he showed up with the next scene with his hands and these enormous cats. Oh, no. Before that, he had these, like, foam rubber hands all kind of swollen and mangled. It's like, look what they've done to my thumbs. Like, I had no idea. It's like, they broke the man's thumbs? Holy shit, what'd they do to this guy?
Broke his thumbs. Can't play pool with broken thumbs.
No. Fucks up your arch too, apparently, even after it heals.
Yeah.
Gotta learn how to stroke all over again.
For sure.
But there again, it's like that's the same. They tell the story like three times in different ways. Like, here's again, like, this guy was winning, but winning wasn't enough. He had to let the other guy know how much he'd fucked him over. And that was his gift, right? Like, Paul Newman's gift was he's good looking and charming, and he can play the, like, oh gosh, I guess I just got lucky so well that people buy it. And he had them, and then he had to let them know, like, actually you got beat by a professional pool shark, and then they broke. That's the thing. Like, I don't understand this lawless nature of the pool, like, where you're just trying to win money and a certain amount of lies and deception are okay. But, like, what kind of world can exist if you beat the local pro bad? And if you beat the local pro, they break your thumbs.
Yeah.
Like, you're pool sharking. I just a better pool shark. You're going to break my thumbs. Like, why would anyone come over there and play pool?
No, it does seem shitty. It's like, and I think this is why this is one of the seedier joints, you know? Like, you go to Ames, that stuff is expected, and you're not going to get your thumbs broken unless you personally attack George C. Scott.
I thought that was the difference between, like, some place like Ames and these two-bit things. But then again, at the end, George C. Scott threatens to break the guy, you know, to break him all over again, because he didn't like that. I don't know. But then I also wondered if that actually would have happened.
Like, no, that last scene is brilliant. I love that last scene where Paul Newman, you know, gives his self-righteous speech about how Bert is just, you know, a broken, hollow person. He's a loser, born loser. And that whole time, it's like the power dynamic there is so intricate and so interesting. Because Paul Newman's coming in there into a den of thieves, calling out the thieves and stealing from them, you know?
Yeah.
And yet he somehow comes out of that feel. You feel like he's almost invincible in that scene, just by the sheer righteousness of his cause, right? And the lumps he's taken along the way, and the ability to bear those all, lay those all bare in front of his abuser. It's a fascinating power dynamic in that final scene, and the, you know, the capper with him and Fats like showing a bit of respect for their games to each other is just, I love that final scene. It's so good.
The director Robert Rosen hired a bunch of like actual nightclub toughs and thugs and like collectors to play the guys that are like surrounding Newman. And I think that's another place for an ambiguity. You're right. He comes in as an audience member. He comes in there at the head of Righteous Steam, and I think he's going to be okay. But like, it was a question in my mind, like if George C. Scott had said, fuck this, you know what? I want my 50%, break this guy's legs.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if his moral weight would protect him, because I could tell that Fats wouldn't like it, but I don't think Fats would also like it, because there's a point where the camera points over to Fats and you can tell that like he thinks this is unseemly, but also he's not going to open his mouth or get up or say anything. And he could have probably. Yeah. And it's just a war of the wills between George C. Scott and Paul Newman. And like they're both kind of like, you know, like, you know, like it's like, hey, if your boys beat me up, they better kill me, because if they don't, I'm going to come back and murder you. It's kind of a little bit of a hustle within the hustle or on top of the hustle. And I really liked it, because, again, I have no idea what would have happened in that room if George C. Scott, like, would that have broken George C. Scott? Like, maybe they would break his arms, but then everybody, you know, he would lose his mystique, you know.
Right. Then he just becomes another thug.
Exactly. He's no longer someone to respect, or you can trust him with your bankroll or whatever. He kind of breaks his whole game too.
And in that scene, I get the impression, and I wish they had made this a little bit clearer, the relationship between Fats and Bert, because I'm a little confused in that scene as to what is going on in Fats' head. I wish I understood if this was like a sadness from a man who is under the thumb of Bert, and deeply understands both the danger and the despair that Fast Eddie is in that moment. Or if this is a man who just simply wants to stay out of the situation that he sees developing, because he doesn't have a relationship, like a business relationship, or, you know, a sort of like oppressor-oppressed relationship with this guy.
Yeah, he does feel kind of like a bit of a free agent. You know, he's benefiting from this environment, and he doesn't want to like throw his weight, no pun intended, on either side of it.
But I'm just not sure if that's what I'm supposed to be thinking about him in that moment, or if I'm supposed to understand the relationship between the two.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess the one flaw that I have in this movie, and it's more of a modernized type of flaw, is it does indulge in the stereotype of a woman has to suffer a maximum consequence as a turning point in the male character's life.
Yeah.
Like, she's essentially a teachable, like, he gets all of his character in the depths that she is forced to fall because of George C. Scott putting the wedge between them. And he's like, I had to lose everything until I got tired of losing. And, you know, it's all about her life. And that's, you know, there's a reason that's a trope that people are kind of moving away from.
Sure.
Not because it's necessarily offensive. It's just like, Jesus Christ, I've seen it in 9 out of 10 action films. The other 1 out of 10 is the daughter instead of the wife or girlfriend. But like that's the one thing that doesn't quite work on but everything else is like, you know, there's terrible things happening, but like it feels like, you know, Sarah, I feel really bad for her, but she feels like that, like if there's that kind of a free-spirited woman with this like kind of checkered past in 1961, it probably looked like that. And Paul Newman looks like and acts like the type of character with his background in that time period as well. I have no idea because there's a lot of questions I have of like, I always wonder why people fall for hustles in pool, because it just feels like you would be like on maximum guard, you know, like anytime someone shows up and starts drinking and has this old story about, because they even lampoon this in that stupid Farley Brothers film Kingpin, you know, like, you got your paycheck and with like Bill Murray does a clumsy version of this and he ends up getting his... Woody Harrelson ends up getting his hands ran through the ball return or whatever.
Yeah.
Like anytime someone comes in, starts drinking and saying he's got a commission check, you just put your hand on your wallet and back away. Right.
Sure.
Like how,
I mean, like, you do it in an arcade, right?
Like, I mean, I guess there's a sucker born every day. Maybe that's the thing, is like you're relying on a steady supply of marks or people that are like overconfident in their own skills or something like that. I don't understand how the hustle works, but it kind of works in a science fiction way that like this world they put in is so consistent and believable and just rock solid in who inhabits it and what it looks like that you just believe that there's places where that's just the way it works, man. It's this weird fucking culture that you can't understand because you're not in it, but it has internally consistent rules that if you follow, you get this outcome. And if you don't, you get that other outcome. But my God, like that George C. Scott, like gave me some serious, like talented Mr. Ripley chills. Like when you really understand the depths of his immorality and lack of character.
Those scenes where he's going at it with Piper Laurie, with Sarah. Yeah.
Sarah
are outstanding. Like I think like George C. Scott is so amazing as this like sleazeball gambler.
Piper with the veneer Laurie, of respectability, yeah.
She's maybe the stagiest of all the actors, I feel.
I would say that the father figure mentor was clearly, he's the old school actor. He's saying his lines, he's saying it.
Okay.
There's no method in his acting at all.
Fair.
He's just a guy saying lines, man.
I mean, she's definitely method acting, but there's something a little, it's like slightly artificial, maybe less easy about the role. But the character is super. And look, I haven't seen a lot of 60s movies, and so I wasn't alive during the 60s, so I don't know much about like, is this a pretty standard role for a woman to have? Is there in these movies a lot of sort of moral arguments that they're presenting to male characters who are really gross, but she's able to do that in these scenes in such a believable way. Like she is as formidable a character as Bert is. And those hotel room scenes are, in my opinion, great. When she's just correctly identifying like exactly what he's trying to do with Eddie and how disgusting it is and just how he's not equipped to really deal with her.
Mm-hmm. And she's tired of playing the game. She's found someone that she thought she could be herself around. And then turns out that, you know, she's not as important to him as she thought, or at least that's what the shakes out. It's funny. Cause there's a lot, there's shades of like Joan's character from Mad Men in the performance, except for like, I think Joan just leaves. She doesn't kill herself in a motel bathroom after taking, cause you know, when she's doing the lipstick of like, I forget what it is. It's like perverted, damaged, perverted, twisted, something. Cripple, and I'm like this is like a sick Instagram shot.
right.
But I thought she's just going to bounce like with George C. Scott's money and leave. But like, you know, her I feel like that's where the Mad Men thing, like Joan would have, you know, gotten up, taken the money and then founded her fucking ad agency. That's how it would have gone. If you told the story nowadays. But and this, like once she loses her chance at like respectability or disrespected respectability, like I'm with a person that understands me and is on the same wavelength and can love me for who I am, she kills herself.
I thought she was so the finality of it, I thought, is what is important here, because if she just bounces, George C. Scott spins this and says, oh yeah, you know, she wasn't here when I got back and
That's true.
She was never good for you anyway. She was clearly hustling you. Look at this. Her killing herself in his bathroom.
Oh, God, yes.
Just puts a stamp on this that says, this man is bad for you. He's driven everything good out of your life. And this is it. Like, you can't look away from that now. There's something she's doing for the character of Fast Eddie in that moment. And, you know, it's a trope, but whatever.
And everything that leads up to that is paced so well. Like, I remember thinking, like, Paul Newman goes to the bellboy and is like, you know, where's the key to my room? And he's got, like, you know, like, giving him significant looks and stuff. I'm like, what the hell? Like, see, he's going to catch him in the act, like, in bed?
Right.
And then you get up there and you see some dudes in suits standing outside, and I'm like, oh. And then there's police officers. I'm like, ah. And then they're interviewing George C. Scott. And, like, the energy, the negative, dark energy just keeps building. Yeah. You're right. They do get a lot of juice from that. And there's a reason this shit is a trope. Because it works so well. Everyone wants to go there, you know?
For sure.
Like, fuck. You know, you want that kind of juice and that emotion in your movies. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, like, I thought the other thing, like, the final like 20 minutes of this movie is just, like, relentless. Like, when he comes in there with a showdown of Fats, and they don't really fuck around with, like, there's no marathon 48-hour pool session. He just, like, dispatches him, and he wins the money, and he goes to leave, and George C. Scott just gets up and screams, "Where's my money?" Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and it's just because I thought the movie was over, and then, like, oh, shit, there's this whole thing. Wow. Yeah.
It's really an excellent climax to this film. And then it's just out, you know, he gives his speech and the thing just ends. He walks out. It's done.
Yeah.
And in the fashion of these old movies, there's no credits at the end. It's just movie's over. The end. I literally says the end.
Well, because they do all the credits up front. That was the charm of doing it that way. You could just like, you know, boom, the movie's done.
And I felt like that worked for me in this, because it got me in the hustler mindset, you know, like it's showing all these shots of these really nice pool shots. It's showing the atmosphere around the city and the drinking and the smoking and everything that comes with that.
It's
life.
Weird, though, because I was reading Ebert's. He didn't have a contemporaneous review of this movie, obviously, because it's old. But he had a great movie review, and he said that this is the reverse structure of most American kind of like hyper-masculine films, in that the hero overcomes not by winning, but by giving in. I don't know that I agree with that assessment. In what way, like, if he'd just gone to Ames and called out George C. Scott and walked out without winning the game and the money and all that stuff, and just been like, you know what, fuck you, and broke his stick and threw it in the corner and just walked out. But he... It's a hero's arc. He won the thing that he wanted to do at great cost and sacrifice, and he grew up and wised up, and, you know, got tired of, like you said, losing. But, like, he didn't give in. I thought that was wild. I didn't agree with his take at all.
I'm struggling to figure out what he means by that.
Yeah, like maybe emotionally or in some kind of Zen Buddhist way. I thought. Also, I thought that. This is a great film, so I'm like, oh, wow, Robert Rosen, I've never heard of him. I've heard of All the King's Men, and that, like, was a monster at the Oscars back in the 50s. And he's got, and I went to look at all the films, like, I figured I'd see a bunch of films of his that he had made. This guy was a member of the American Communist Party and was blacklisted from Hollywood throughout almost the entire 50s. There's this huge hole in his career where he didn't make any film, and then he made this film. As you mentioned in the pre-podcast, it got its ass kicked at the Oscars. It got nominated for almost everything.
Yeah,
got its ass kicked by West Side Story. Fair enough.
I love West Side Story.
He made one more film, and was so disillusioned by the process of that he gave up filmmaking forever and never went behind the camera again.
Wow.
And I'm like, God damn, a tragedy. It's like Muhammad Ali. Yeah. You know, the U.S. government put him in prison for the prime of his fucking career, for the temerity of saying that the war in Vietnam is immoral. Yeah, like I said, I just thought, God damn, that what a tragic backstory to this already bleak, tragic backstory, that this was essentially his final film that that was anything. And who knows how many more films he had in him had he not gotten blacklisted. And also, it wasn't for necessarily his involvement in the Communist Party, but like when he refused to give up names, and they called him up in all the Red Scare hearings, he pled the fifth as his right as an American citizen, and they ran him out of town for it. It's fucking crazy. So
yeah, that sucks. I will say,
I do want to see All the King's Men, because I've never seen it and I hear it's amazing.
I haven't either. I haven't seen many movies from this era, but I was impressed by the cinematography in this, and it did win the Oscar for that. There were two Oscars that it won. One was for cinematography, one was for art direction, both black and white versions of that, and I take that to mean that they also had the color versions of those awards, which seems strange to me, but okay.
At this kind of transitional period in Hollywood, I wonder if it's kind of like silent versus talkie. Like, did you have separate awards for that, or kind of like now? It's like they have animated versus best and foreign, and that's starting to become as things are more and more global, and as like animated films are more and more adult, like
they have changed the awards that they give out from time to time over the years.
Have to
but yeah, I just recall seeing a lot of shots that were really cool. Like one of the screenshot that I'm going to be using for this podcast is a low shot at the end of the table with both Jackie Gleason and Paul Newman looking down at taking their lagging shots to see who goes first. Very cool shot, very artfully done at a time when now that shot is just like commonplace and it's run of the mill. But back then, I imagine it was something special.
Well, they used that language. I read an essay about this film, and I want to go back and rewatch to see how much I pick out the second time. Kind of like when I first saw Parasite, the movie, and I'm like, man, this is an amazing film. And then I read a visual thing that showed like all the different like vertical and horizontal like planes and lines that are crossed in the film, like junction, like corners of windows and like lines in the street and where characters cross lines. I'm like, oh my God, this is like on visual storytelling on a whole other level. I guess the cinematographer deliberately framed like shots where like Robert Newman is shot from like above and where you're looking down on him when he's in a morally low position, and then he's shot down low looking up at him when he's in a morally like a upwards trajectory. And then there's like, they use that like altitude of the film when they're shooting those pool scenes to suggest where he's at. And I'm like, I don't know if that even like, I don't know if that works on a subconscious level. I kind of feel like it does, but it's almost like it doesn't have to be. It's like one of those things. I think that's, that stuff you pick up as you appreciate film more and more. Like it's got like learning English, you know. You can baby talk at the beginning and you can, you know, say, you know, I want cookie or me thirsty or me sleepy. And then you can form more and more complex ideas and understand more and more complex ideas. And it's stuff like that. It's like, I don't know if it works on a subconscious level. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, the spatial stuff, but it's another thing. It's another way to appreciate the storytelling and the detail and the artistry. What it is, artistry. Like the composition shots, at that has nothing to do with the plot. It's just the artistry of it. And a lot of these old films, you know, especially since they those techniques weren't like in a book that you could just study. It's just like someone coming up like, what can I do to underline what the director and the writer is trying to do here? Oh, I know, I'll change the altitude of the shot or whatever. Like that's the thing I think is really rewarding about seeing some of these old ass movies, is like, what are the techniques that every film does nowadays, but were like visionary at the time.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So, anything else to say about The Hustler? Have we hustled it out?
I did want to put some perspective on the sums of money, the stakes that they're playing for here. Cause you mentioned in passing the $10 would be a fair bit of money nowadays. It's something on the order of about $86. And when you extrapolate to the games that they play later, and I like how the stakes are raised throughout the film, both, you know,
sure,
emotionally and monetarily. By the end, they're playing for, they start at $1,000 and they get up to $3,000 a game, and $3,000 in today's money is about $26,000 per game that they're playing for.
I was thinking that, yeah, well, when he's taking wanting to win $10,000, he's winning like $100,000. He's winning 3 years' pay.
Yeah.
Back in the day, like in a single night, and yet he still feels like a loser.
Right. Yeah, it's a huge amount of money. The stakes are enormously high. I was surprised by
they
that.
They do play a lot about like these cycles of addiction and need and being empty, and they do a lot of interesting things because like her, you know, Paul Newman and Piper Laurie are in kind of like a locked in dance that like at some points like some of them are they're healthy at some times and the other person's not, and then that one of them will do something to sabotage a good time that the other is having. Some of them get in their feelings when they don't need to. I'm gonna watch this a couple more times for sure. Cecily came in like halfway through the movie when like a particularly good Sarah versus Fast Eddie scene, and she's like, oh my god, I want to, because like, yeah, this it's a great it's a really great role for a woman back in the day, I'd imagine.
I think so, yeah.
All right, well, that'll do it for The Hustlers. Next week's movie is going to be a 180-degree departure from this one. Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
Very colorful, very profane, but also has a lot of themes about self-discovery and finding out who you are and being happy with it. So maybe it's a little bit more in common with The Hustler than I imagine. And, you know, I guess The Hustler was very seedy and kind of, you know, grimy and unsavory if you could decode the parlance of the day. So yeah, we're gonna be doing Scott Pilgrim's the 10th year anniversary. I love this film. It was tragically unappreciated at the box office in its day, and I still don't think people give it its due. Mm-hmm. It's Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright. Yep.
Yeah. Not in this Coronado trilogy. It's like one of his off, but like it's a really, really good film that I immediately loved, and just no one went out to see it. I don't understand why. We're going to be giving it a little bit of love on its 10th anniversary. That sounds like a good idea or good time to you. Check it out and join us for the conversation next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.